From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 229, recorded live Thursday, August 19th, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Andrew Arnott about OpenID and OpenAuth.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. This week on Hansel Minutes, I am sporting a summer cold. It is 96 degrees outside, and I am sick as a dog. But fortunately, my guest, Andrew Arnott, is not sick. Are you well, sir?
I am.
Fantastic. That makes at least one of us, because I am dying over here. It's absolutely ridiculous. I feel like it's a Christmas cold, and it's in the heat of the summer.
I just got over a cold myself.
All right. Yeah, everyone is sick right now. So you are the lead on the .NET OpenAuth project.
That's right.
Can you explain to me, this used to be called .NET OpenID, and there's always open this and open that, and I think that most people who are listening know of OpenAuth because they know that sometimes an application will ask Twitter for permission to do something, and that's their exposure to OpenAuth. But can you kind of back up a little bit and explain what OpenID is, why your project changed from OpenID to OpenAuth, and kind of explain this open ecosystem out there for me?
Sure. So OpenID is an open protocol for authentication, and .NET OpenID was one of the first .NET libraries to implement OpenID. It would just authenticate users. It wouldn't give them the sites that they're logging into permission to access their information on some other website, though, for example, Twitter. You've probably seen the sign in with Twitter buttons.
Right, right. So you can sign into a site. You're not signing into Twitter. You're signing into a particular site using your Twitter ID.
Exactly, exactly. That's typically, you know, the scenario that OpenID covers. Twitter, however, because people who sign in with Twitter typically want to be able to socialize and say, hey, I'm doing such and such on this particular website. Maybe I'm listening to an MP3 while they're on some music playing website. And they want to be able to have that website automatically tell their Twitter friends what they're listening to. So Twitter has chosen, instead of using OpenID, they were one of the first adopters of OAuth, which they've co-opted to also be authentication, but they're using it for its authorization aspect as well, so that as you're logging in using Twitter, you're also granting the site you're logging into permission to post to your Twitter feed. So .NET OpenID, because OAuth was becoming more and more popular, added OAuth support, and at that point, calling the library OpenID when that was only half of the story did not make as much sense. In fact, it also did InfoCard, which was another open protocol that Microsoft started. So renamed it to .NET OpenAuth, and it did OpenID, OAuth, and InfoCard, and tried to wrap that together. That's kind of the history.
But OpenID and OpenAuth don't relate to each other in any way?
That's mostly accurate. They're orthogonal in that you can use one or the other, or you can use them together, and yet they don't interact at all. However, if you're going to use them both, if you want to, say, log in with your Google account and access that person's maybe Gmail contact list or something, using them independently but together means that you have to go see the Google website twice. So they have actually invented a hybrid protocol that does both at the same time. So at that point, they do have something to do together, but they're still mostly independent protocols.
Okay. So looking at OpenID itself, I implemented this in DOS Blog quite a while back, actually. And it was I did it back, I think, before you existed or right when you started doing the OpenID. .NET, do you remember if DOS Blog uses .NET OpenID?
I remember back when you did it. Yeah, I think .NET OpenID, or back when we called it Janrain OpenID.
Right, and it was a very early thing, and it was quite innovative at the time. And you can see this on my blog. At the bottom, it says OpenID, and I have a little ID selector. And then on that ID selector, there's a link that says get an OpenID, and it sends you off to a third party called myopenid.com. But I don't need to necessarily go and get an OpenID, right? I may already have one.
Yeah, almost everybody on the internet has one, just because Google, Yahoo, and several other very popular email providers are also OpenID providers. So there's, I think somebody estimated either 20 million or 40 million or something OpenIDs out there already. Most of the people don't realize they have one.
Okay, so I know that like Flickr is an OpenID, Google is an OpenID. These are all places where if you have a login, for example, on my blog, if you have a login to Flickr, you can just click Flickr, you put in Flickr and hit login, and it'll prompt you for your Flickr password. You're giving your Flickr password to Flickr, right? Not to my blog.
Right.
And what is that interaction there? Because I know there's a redirect. You go to Flickr, you sign in, you come back, and then suddenly I have your name, I have information about you. How is that handoff handled?
There's a couple ways. The basic flow is, just like you said, it's a redirect where your blog disappears momentarily and I see Flickr, which has the advantage of your Hanselman.com URL changes to Flickr.com, and I feel confident that I'm not giving my password to a site that I otherwise might not trust. Mm-hmm. And then Flickr authenticates me and redirects with a special authentication token that Hanselman.com can process and verify that it's real. And yet, without ever seeing my password, your site knows that I am some Flickr user, and whatever information you asked Flickr to provide with my authentication, if I, while logging in, said that was okay, you may already have my email address, my name, you know, whatever it is, so that my login into your blog is that much more convenient. The enhancement to that flow is using a pop-up window, which is becoming more and more popular, where instead of actually leaving your site, it's just a small area of your page that is now occupied by Flickr, and I can log in that way. There's a bit more JavaScript intensity in that, and you still have to have a browser. It's a full-blown browser window. It's not just an AJAX dialog, again, just so the URL can show up so users know that they're not giving their password to the wrong site.
Okay. So if I, from the point of view of the user, let's say from the point of view of the browser, because most of us who are listening are web developers in some way, I type in flickr.com, I hit save comment, in the instance that I'm trying to save a comment at my blog. I'm redirected to Flickr. I sign in to Flickr. Flickr receives the post for my password, decides whether or not it's really me, then redirects back over, and they put something in the URL.
That's right.
Right? What is happening in the back? Because I don't understand how someone couldn't just steal or lie. How do I know that the secret that is redirected back? So I'm going to leave you Hanselman.com, yada, yada, yada. Secret OpenID thing. How do I know that's not a lie? Is there some server-side handshake that's occurring with that client-side redirection?
Yes, absolutely. When the user types in that they are a Flickr user or a Google user, whatever identifier they type in, or in your blog's case, they just click on Flickr and that all happens automatically. But what your blog does before it redirects to Flickr is it has a handshake with Flickr in which your site and Flickr establish a shared secret, which is then used for an HMAC signature. With that secret, an HMAC signature. It's a hash of, so in the authentication token that Flickr will send back to your blog, which otherwise anybody could forge, right? They just change, I signed in as Andrew Arnett, but I'm going to go change it in the URL to say Scott Hanselman, and then they'll think that Scott is logging in instead of me. The reason that can't be done is because with all that information about the person and who it is and what their real identifier is, they hash it. But at the end of the data that they're hashing, they concatenate that shared secret, which makes the hash not reproducible after somebody has changed the data because they don't have the shared secret to tack onto the end of it.
I see. So that makes it cryptographically significant?
Yeah. Yeah, it makes it extremely difficult, depending on the length of the hash. And OpenID has a couple of different hash lengths that it can use. It's practically infeasible. Mm-hmm. Boost that.
And you're saying HMEX, M-E-X?
HMAC, H-M-A-C.
H-M-A-C, I see. Okay, so then I sign into Flickr. There's a discussion back and forth between the client and the server, as well as the server and the server, to make sure that who Hanselman.com thinks you're talking to is also who, in fact, your browser is talking to. So if something bad happened and I had like an evil toolbar and I wasn't really talking to Flickr, I could be assured, though, that the Hanselman.com server was, in fact, talking to Hanselman.com, and then the shared secrets would not match.
True. Although if you've got an evil toolbar, they can't, and you're not really talking to Flickr.com, well, you've just given your password away to the evil website. They can do whatever they want now anyway. They own your identity. So it's important to trust the toolbars you install.
Mm-hmm. And then the shared secret is a hash-based message authentication code, MAC, message authentication code, hence an HMAC. And that's a well-known thing. That's not an OpenID thing. It's the same kind of thing that you use in, you know, in IPsec and TLS and things like that.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. One other attack, since you mentioned the whole substituting Flickr for an evil site. The way OpenID has a couple of different ways of exchanging that shared secret. One of them is really secure, and that is if Flickr is using HTTPS, then you get the whole public key infrastructure assurance that they are really talking to Flickr. But in the case, if you're just doing standard HTTP, then and if there's a DNS poisoning attack occurring at your blog or whatever, what's called the relying party, then OpenID resorts to the Diffie-Hellman algorithm for exchanging a secret, in which case there's no identity assurance. And so so OpenID without HTTPS is vulnerable to DNS poisoning attacks. So it's important to always use an HTTPS OpenID.
That sounded really, really interesting, but I'm going to tease you a little bit because I heard blah, 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 DNS poisoning, blah, 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 Diffie-Hellman, blah, 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 bad. So break that down for me. That sounds really interesting. What bad thing can happen that will hurt me and kill my family?
If somebody can get a server both between your computer and Flickr, and between the site you're trying to log into and Flickr, so if they can intercept network requests, and if they can pull off a DNS poisoning attack, which is actually fairly difficult, but it's possible.
What does that mean, that a poisoning attack?
It means how you'd pull it off is if nobody has logged in using Flickr to your blog recently, so that the server that your blog is running on doesn't know where Flickr.com is, then an attacker could get your server, you know, start the login process using Flickr so that your server has to look up basically in the white pages for the internet where Flickr.com is. And it knows that your server is going to ask the white pages out on the internet, where is Flickr.com? And it won't see that request, but it can pretend to be the response to that by flooding your DNS server with responses of here's Flickr.com, except that it's giving it the wrong address, so that your site will blindly trust it, send out a request to establish a shared secret with a spoofed copy of Flickr.com.
Mm-hmm.
So that fake server can now send that forged authentication token.
Okay.
If it can accomplish that, then somebody can log in as anybody, essentially, from Flickr to your blog. So again, that's why HTTPS is really important. If you're logging into a website using OpenID, make sure you're using an HTTPS identifier so that somebody else can't spoof your identity later in the case of a DNS poisoning attack.
Okay. So this is actually, because as a developer, this is interesting, but what I really want to know is, how is this going to make me do one thing or the other, make a decision to develop my application? And I'm hearing you say, if I'm going to use OpenID, I really need to use SSL. And should I be doing additional verification on the certificates as well?
You should enable, as a developer of the site, you should enable certificate revocation list checks, which is typically off by default because it comes with a small perf hit. And yes, you can consider just setting OpenID on your site to only accept SSL-protected identifiers, for example. For blogs, that's probably overkill. But if you were going to log into a site that was carrying highly confidential information, you definitely want this protection in there.
Now, how much of that is going to be done automatically by your library versus what kind of manual verification should I be doing?
So .NET OpenOffice defaults to, it does have some protections that supersede the standard OpenID spec in place that are on by default when they don't compromise interoperability, except in obviously insecure, exploited cases. But there are just a couple of settings that you could easily just change to true in your web config file, for example, to say, hey, I want to require SSL. And then throughout the whole pipeline, both at the browser and with, from server-to-server communication, make sure that SSL is always used. There's even higher levels of assurance that the U.S. government has come up with that they call it the ICAM OpenID profile that requires SSL and requires a whole bunch of other restrictions that make OpenID even more secure. And that also is just a flip of a switch in .NET OpenOffice to turn that all on.
Hi, this is Scott. I just want to remind you guys that there's no show without a sponsor. Somebody's got to pay for all this bandwidth, and the more popular the show becomes, the more important it is that we thank our sponsors, folks like Telerik. Now, I want to let you guys know that Telerik has got a pretty cool deal going between June 1st, 2010 and August 31st, 2010. Any interested listener, just send an email to podcast@Telerik, TELERIK.com. Mention Hansel Minutes, and they will reply, and they'll give you a special $50 off coupon code. So just remember, podcast@Telerik.com. Mention Hansel Minutes, $50 off. This goes until August 31st, 2010. And big thanks again for the folks at Telerik for believing in our show and for continuing to help pay for our expenses.
I use OpenID for comments, but and I suppose it wouldn't really matter if I didn't make it really secure. But I suppose if I was doing online banking, I would want to turn all those things on and insist
Absolutely.
On security.
Absolutely. Although I don't know any banks that actually let you log into OpenID. There are some banks or bank-like websites that are OpenID providers. Mm-hmm. They just haven't seen the business risk as palatable to become relying parties.
That is the really interesting thing, that term that you just used, the OP or the RP, the originating party or the relying party. The idea that it's a chain of trust. So if I'm a bank, do I want to trust Flickr and 15 other sites, or do I want to be a trusted party? So you're saying that it's more likely for a bank as a big trusted institution to become the one that is trusted.
Right.
As opposed to the one who has to trust everyone.
Right. Because the bank doesn't know what Flickr's authentication and security rules are.
One of the things that I've noticed on my blog, and I don't know if it's my implementation or if it's an old thing, but I know that the number one complaint on my blog is when people log in with Google as their OpenID, which when they click the little OpenID thing, Google shows up and it's, it seems to be the most popular one. I'm looking at my most recent post. I've got 6 OpenID comments. So OpenID is very popular on my blog. 3 of them have this crazy Google URL. Google/accounts/ID, blah, 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 blah. And they all have the same identicon. Well, the other ones of people who have OpenIDs that are custom, makes more sense. It looks like the picture of them. It uses their name. What is the deal? Do I have something wrong with my implementation, or is it known that Google sucks in this way?
Google has pioneered the actual use of something called directed identity, which OpenID 2.0 made possible, which gives users who log in with their Google OpenID accounts extra identity protection. The result of that is a very ugly OpenID identifier, which is what you're referring to here that you see on your blog. It's not something that anybody could understand, and that was deliberate on Google's part, but it doesn't make for very good blog comments. What people who accept OpenIDs from Google seem to be doing lately is they do consume that URL that's awful to look at internally, but while they're authenticating the user with Google, they're also asking for the user's full name and or email address so that they can display that instead.
Okay, so but that's a Google thing. You're saying I need to treat Google differently.
Google has had has had some very odd behaviors from other OpenID providers. They've actually changed that to agree with, you know, the behavior of a lot of others. Google and Yahoo both can do this, although Yahoo's willing to give a nicer looking one. So in general, though, you can special case Google if you want to, or you can just ask for the email address and name. In fact, you probably, I don't know if you do or not, but one of the advantages of OpenID, right, is when that authentication token comes back, you can get the name and email address of the person who's logging in. So if you're not requesting that yet, you can do so when you're going through Google, and then just display that instead of the identifier, and Google will look nicer, and possibly so will everybody else's.
Ah, okay. Well, then I need to talk to you about fixing that, because that is a huge complaint, and it just... Every OpenID provider out there works just fine, but Google simply won't give me their name and email address.
So I can help you with that. Google and Yahoo both have some special requirements before they'll actually give name and email address, and Google has a unique one.
So, now, is that something that I can do? Do I have to change code to do that? Because I haven't rebuilt. My version of DOSBlog has been extremely stable. It works very, very nicely. It's been wonderful for a couple of years now. Is this a matter of me just changing some markup so that Google talks to me and says, oh, that looks nice? Or am I going to go in and change my handshake?
It may. It depends on how closely you comply with Google's security requirements. An OpenID site, and I think we worked on this on your blog already, so assuming we had it working, I don't recall whether we finished it or not. Your mm-hmm. site does have to have a special RP discovery feature implemented so that Google can see that indeed the authentication request did come from your site. Mm-hmm. And then when you make the request to Google, you need to ask for the name and email address and mark them as required. When you send, when a website sends to Google an OpenID request, you can say, these are the attributes about the person that I want, and I consider mm-hmm. each one either optional or required. Google chooses to ignore all optional requests. So you never get the email address if you only say, hey, I'd like it if I can get it, but I'll take it without it. I'm like, fine, we'll send it without it.
That's the trick. That's the interesting thing. Even if you mark, I would like the user's email address, and you say optional, all of the other relying parties will say, sure, here you go. Google will not give you anything unless you say, I need it. Otherwise, we're not talking at all.
Right. And the unfortunate thing about that is if you are willing to accept it without an email address, really, but by upgrading it to required, now Google users cannot post to your blog using their OpenID unless they're willing to give up the email address. Because Google does honor that part of the OpenID spec where if you mark it required, authentication cannot continue unless they're willing to do it. Whereas with optional, it's supposed to be a checkbox.
The difficult thing is that I'm not using their email address. I'm not going to email them. I'm not going to bother them. I just want to show a little icon. I want to show a gravatar of what this person looks like. And what happens is, since I don't have an email address, all I can use is the Google account ID that they gave me and put up a generic icon, which is very sad.
That's right, because you'll never get, Google will never give you a well-known host name or something that somebody could associate a gravatar with, because even if somebody took that really awful URL and associated a gravatar with it somewhere, they would log into another website using the same Google account, and that URL would be different, which is what the directed identity feature is all about. So the gravatar would once again be the default one, which would be very frustrating for users. However, there is a new button that you could add to your OpenID that would solve this problem. That is, in addition to the Google OpenID provider that you're using now, there's Google Profiles is now an OpenID provider as well. But it behaves much more like the rest of the OpenID providers in that you actually get a reasonable URL that people can recognize that has your name in it. And it's persistent across all the websites you log into, so the gravatar thing works.
Does everyone have a Google profile already?
No, you have to actually have visited Google Profiles and turned it on, but that's a simple procedure. What it would be is another, next to the Google button on your little selector, you'd probably have a Google Profiles button. Or you could, I don't know if this would work, I haven't tried it myself, maybe replace the Google button with the Google Profiles button, and maybe anybody who hasn't been to Google Profiles before will automatically get set up as part of the login, I don't know.
Well, you know, the thing is that you got to go where the users are, right? And I'm looking at such a typical blog post here. I've got 6 comments, 3 are Google. users and three aren't. And that's just so classic. So I think I'm going to make my application smarter. It needs to work with Google, even though Google is not 100% playing by the OpenID rules.
Cool.
So one of the other things that you and I worked on was on Nerd Dinner, nerddinner.com, for Mix this year, we updated the site that you can RSVP via Twitter. So this is a good opportunity to talk about OpenAuth. If you go to nerddinner.com and you pick a dinner, you can say RSVP for the event. And this is an MVC site. So this is not a web form site like DOSBlog is. But there's still some URL stuff going on here. We say RSVP Twitter begin. We click on that. It says waiting for Nerd Dinner. And then now I'm over at twitter.com/OAuth. And then there's a token that's appeared. And I'm just going to put in my name and password here. And I hit sign in. It says the application Nerd Dinner by Scott Hanselman would like you to sign in using your Twitter account. How did Twitter know that Nerd Dinner was asking for this?
That token that you noticed in the URL a moment ago, mm-hmm. That token was established between Nerd Dinner and Twitter just before sending you over there, which said not only that it was Nerd Dinner asking, but it associated it with this particular user so that when it comes back to Nerd Dinner knows where you left off.
So Nerd Dinner, the server, talked to Twitter a moment ago and agreed on this token and then sent it over on the browser.
Yep.
So that's interesting. So
it's similar to OpenID in the sense that there's that server-to-server interaction before the redirect, except that with OpenID, that server-to-server interaction doesn't always happen. In fact, it usually doesn't because the shared secret works multiple times. Whereas with OAuth, there is a unique token for every single user login.
And that sounds better.
It's different. In fact, with OAuth 2.0, they're eliminating that step entirely. So it's just a different way to fill a different scenario.
Mm-hmm. If I go to twitter.com, and this was a problem last week. I'm going to go to twitter.com and I'm going to click on settings at the top here. And then I'm going to go from settings, I'm going to go to connections, which is a choice of, this is a Twitter thing. And in connections is a huge list of applications, way larger than I would have expected. And these are all, it says you have allowed the following applications to access your account. I'm like, oh, I remember that, and I remember that, and da, da, da. What are all these applications here?
They typically are the apps that you have actually clicked sign in with Twitter at. And many of these apps, even though they only claim to be using your Twitter account to let you log in and that they won't actually post, they don't bother limiting their own access. And so if you're reviewing these apps, you can see this person has read-write access to your feed, and you know, many of those, you'll think, whoa, I didn't realize I was granting permission. I thought I was just logging in, which is one of the advantages of, like you said, going to this page and reviewing so you can revoke permissions you didn't mean to grant.
Right. I've actually written two applications using OpenAuth, and I'm seeing here nerddinner.com by Scott Hanselman, approved on March 12th, read and write access. And then I go down a little bit farther, and then I have Tweet Sandwich. Tweet Sandwich is my program that lets Quiznos take orders over Twitter, and it says read-only access. So Tweet Sandwich can use its shared secret. It's holding an HMAC, isn't it, in its local database, and it can use that kind of secret personal one-time password for as long as it wants to, until I say no, you can't use it anymore.
Yeah, some of these tokens can have expiration dates in them. Twitter doesn't build in support for any of those expiration dates, so you're right. Until you cancel this, or until Tweet Sandwich has fallen out of favor with Twitter, because they could cancel them all at once. They can read your feed. And one interesting thing is your feed is public, right? Why do you need read access to read my feed? That doesn't make any sense. Except you can actually send private IMs or feed status updates that are mm-hmm. marked as secret so that only people who are following you can read them. If you have read access, that is actually giving you the permission to read those private notices. So that is more than public access.
Interesting. I'm surprised that It's I wrote Tweet Sandwich. It says September 2009. We're almost a year later, and it can still talk to Twitter.
And it's resilient against changing passwords, and that's something to keep in mind as well. I mean, that's a selling point of OAuth is, since you never gave away your password, you can change your password without disrupting all the apps that you've authorized. But it also means that if you suspect that your account has been compromised, typically the response to that is, I'll change my password. But that doesn't disrupt these connections. And so if you think that it's one of your apps that you've authorized that are spamming your account or something, you need to go through and changing your password is usually a good idea anyway, but you need to revoke access to the app that's doing the spamming specifically.
And what happened? Did you notice what happened on Twitter just a couple days ago around kind of OpenAuth applications running wild and spamming people?
I'd heard about that. That's another one of those unfortunate misconceptions about OAuth. Is it provides some security for the user? In that they don't have to give their password to some unknown party. But for some reason, users don't think anything about, well, I'm not giving my password away, so I'll just go ahead and authorize this app because I'm totally safe. Well, no, you are authorizing the app to spam your account. Mm-hmm. So you should trust the app anyway. It's just a benefit that you don't have to give away your password. So, yeah. Just,
so what
you
got to
be smart about what apps you trust.
What happened was a 17-year-old boy, actually, not a guy, wrote an application called Twificiency, because apparently putting TW in front of any word makes it more awesome. Should change it to Twopenoff or something like that. He wrote a little application just so he could learn OpenAuth, and it would basically log you in, look at your tweets, apply some, you know, magic dust to it, come up with a number, and then tweet, I just checked my Twificiency. It was 8%. And then everyone, of course, Twitter is run almost entirely by ego and hubris. So everyone's like, oh, what's my Twificiency? So we all run off. And because it's a thing that tweets your Twificiency, then it would cause more people to want to go and see it. But the issue was that it was tweeting, meaning it was writing to your account without asking.
Right. And
that's not something that really has anything to do with OpenAuth. That's more of an etiquette thing, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, OAuth can't solve that problem. If you're logging in or giving that app from the 17-year-old permission to write to your feed, then OAuth at that point comes out of the picture. It was there to establish the authorization, and after that, the app can do whatever it wants.
Exactly. It's funny how that works. I'm glad that people realized it was an etiquette issue and not a protocol issue.
Yeah.
What do I need to do to get started if I want to go right now and add OpenID or OpenAuth to my application?
If it's a .NET application, you can go download .NET OpenAuth and look at the samples and get started. We've got authorization server, which is our service provider in OAuth 1.0 terms, and consumer samples, as well as OpenID relying party and OpenID provider samples. So everything that you could need is there. OAuth, by the way, works for desktop and web applications, whereas OpenID is strictly just web applications, so .NET OpenAuth has some samples for all of those things. If you aren't using .NET, if you're using PHP or one of the many others, you can go to either OpenID.net or OAuth.net, those sites themselves, and click on libraries, and there's dozens of libraries available for the many other web platforms out there.
Very cool. And this is just www.dotnetopenauth.net.
That's right.
Very cool. Well, thanks, Andrew, for educating me about this. I really appreciate it. I think that lots of people out there are writing their own membership systems, and really we should stop storing names and passwords and password hashes in our own databases. If somebody's already got a login, we should use it.
That's right. And it's really important as you're writing these apps, use a library. A lot of people think, oh, these libraries are big, it's an extra dependency, I'll just implement OpenID or OAuth myself. I tell you, every time somebody thinks that, they write a very buggy implementation that is worse than just taking a username and password from a user. So it's really important, use a well-established, trusted library. Don't try to write a security library yourself, it's just too hazardous.
Well, I can definitely attest to that. I remember when I started with DOSBlog, and you probably remember as well, I figured, oh, I'll just do a little HTTP post over here, and it'll be no problem. It was so much easier. And I remember when we did the Nerd Dinner sample, we were able to get that working in a couple of hours. It was really trivial. It's not, once you understand the flow, it's not difficult at all.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.